This is The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to The Guardian Football Weekly. Our job, should we choose to accept it, is to bring life and excitement to the second round of the Carabao Cup. Loads of penalties scored by players who'd all had a decent warm-up. QPR and Stoke springing the surprises. Susie Rack will join us as England's World Cup qualifying campaign reads played 2-1-2. 4-18 against 0 sounds competitive. Nick Ames went to Moldova to find out about Champions League minnows FC Sheriff, so we'll ask him about that. Also, will a certain panellist dig his heels in on Ronaldo? There's the latest on Jack Swift's move to Ajax, and who is Ronnie Brunswick and what is he doing? All that plus your questions, and that's today's Guardian Football Weekly. Jacob says, is this seismic pod lineup a potential cause of the earthquake we felt in Australia today? Let's review. Max moved to Sydney. Nothing, says Shiz. Barry returns to the pod. Riots in Melbourne. Australia betray the French and buy nuclear submarines. Earthquake. Cause, effect, question mark. Barry Glendenning, welcome.
Hello, hello, hello.
Jonathan Wilson, hello.
Morning, how are you doing?
I am marvellous, thank you. Hello, Nick Ames.
Hello, Max, how are you doing?
Yeah, I'm all right. I had my first earthquake today. The building shook slightly and I shat myself. I think that would be the easy conclusion while everyone else carried on with their day. Nobody told me. They told me about the sharks and the spiders and the things, but they didn't tell me about the earthquakes. Not acceptable. It should have been on a form, shouldn't it? P.S. There are earthquakes. Anyway, Joshua says, should we just give Man City the trophy now and avoid having to play all these extra games? What is the point of the League Cup? Well, I mean, I wanted to, before we got into the second round games, not sort of massive excitement with the games yesterday, but we'll rattle through them in a second. Just sort of wondered where the League Cup is currently, Wilson. How do we feel about it? What should we feel about it?
Well, you can feel what you want about it. I don't think there's a right or wrong answer to this. I mean, at the moment, it feels pretty futile. The big teams are playing. I mean, not even the big teams. Sunderland put out a weakened side against Wigan last night, and I was quite annoyed that they won. It feels like a waste of goals and a waste of a clean sheet, particularly against a team who are level with Sunderland at the top of League One. So at the moment, it does feel slightly pointless. And you know, I tried to watch Liverpool v Norwich last night, Norwich v Liverpool last night, and as soon as the first goal went in after 4 minutes, it's like, okay, it's done. I listened to a podcast with the sound off until the penalty was missed, and then I watched Sunday's Endeavour instead in the second half.
Sorry, you listened to a podcast with the volume down. It seems difficult.
The volume on the TV down.
Right, okay.
Sorry, I have a question.
Yes?
Was it a podcast you were on?
Yes, it was.
Oh, I knew it.
but I think by sort of the quarterfinals, semi-finals, the Carabao Cup, yeah, feels meaningful. And it's so meaningful. I don't know, is this widely known? I didn't know this. It's so meaningful. Phil Foden feels so fondly about the Carabao Cup, a competition that City have dominated in recent years. He has a French bulldog called Carabao.
Does he?
Yeah.
God. What era would be the best era to have had a dog? Rumbelows? That's a good name for a dog.
Littlewoods.
I don't think you're going to get better than Rumbelows.
Yeah, Milk or Coca-Cola seems a bit weird.
Milk is quite a good name. Carling is a pretty... That's a terrible name for a dog.
Or just the Football League. So, yeah, late 70s, going down the park. Here, Football League.
I suppose we have the same feeling about all cup competitions. I mean, the FA Cup third round still has excitement and interest, doesn't it, Nick? But maybe all the tournaments, they do get more exciting come the quarterfinal. But it does feel a bit... It just feels a bit...
The second
round of the Carabao.
It does, but we've been talking about this for about 20 years now. Well, I mean, we haven't, because we haven't known each other 20 years, but like, one has been expressing views on that for about 20 years, and it's still here, and people still invest from kind of a quarter semis onwards. And like, I agree, it's patchy. Like, you look at the team Wickham put out last night at Man City, and I think they had their best attackers on the bench, players like Horgan, Vokes, McCleary, stuff like that. And you kind of think, well, if you're not going to make the most of your big day out, what is the point? But it kind of at this point serves as a petri dish for managers, doesn't it? Like, one year they might play 11 kids, another year, as Klopp did last night, they might mix it up a bit more, and you might get a bit more out of it. I kind of think we talk about this every year, and it sort of, it rolls with the punches, and eventually we get on with it, don't we?
The thing is, it's not compulsory. If you're not interested, you don't have to watch it. We have to sort of feign some sort of mild interest in it, but it's fine. I would imagine in a lot of people's heads, it ranks somewhere below both transfer windows in terms of, you know, winning a trophy. But it's fine. I'd quite like Sunderland to win it. I'd quite like if they'd got knocked out yesterday. But, you know, if you're not interested in the early rounds, you don't have to take any interest in them.
I suppose we're in danger of asking, has the League Cup lost its magic? Which reminds me of my favourite phone-in I've done quite a while. I think probably with you, Barry, is, has the phone-in, has the FA Cup lost its magic, lost its magic? It's a good one to do. Look, Man City are going for their fifth successive League Cup. Maybe they could go for 10 in a row. That might make it quite interesting. Wickham did have their moment, right? And that was a really lovely thing to see. Brandon Hanlon giving them the lead. The Wickham fans and players getting very excited about it. But then, you know, all Pep's kids scored goals. De Bruyne, Mahrez, Foden, Ferran Torres. There was one, Cole Palmer, and his finish was lovely. You noticed, Baz, that Pep saluted Adebayo Akinfenwa.
Yeah, I mean, Pep seemed remarkably enthused by this win, and he really excited about it, more so than he would after winning a title even. But he gave five senior debuts to players. They all played well. And then, yeah, sang the praises of Akinfenwa, the legend, afterwards, saying they faced a legend of English football. It was a pleasure to meet him. So if I was Adebayo Akinfenwa, I think I'd quite like being noticed by various top-flight managers, because Jurgen Klopp has done it as well, you know, gone on about how great he is and sent him messages. But it's also slightly patronising, I think. But I suppose it's nice to be noticed. And he did give a very inexperienced Manchester City back four quite a lot to think about, because, you know, he's a hard man to get a handle on.
I like how you call him Akinfenwa, like Akinfenwa Park.
What is his name? Sorry, have I got it wrong?
Akinfenwa.
Sorry, I do apologise.
There's no why. If you apologise to Bio, and if he's not happy, he can go over round your house and beat you up.
Yeah.
Can't he? Robin says, which League One side do you think Man City will get in the next round? They do have quite a nice run of things, generally, in this competition. So we'll find out tomorrow, I presume. QPR knocked out Everton on penalties. It was nice to see Charlie Austin score two goals. The second was a lovely little header. My only other note on this game is Elias Chair might be my favourite name in football at the moment. Tom Davies missed the crucial penalty. Rafa said, we did quite well. We had 17 attempts, showed good character. We have to be better in both areas. Well done to Queen's Park Rangers. Stoke won at Watford with two quite fluky goals. Sam Clucas. I hadn't considered Sam Clucas for a while, so it was nice to be reminded of Sam's existence. Liverpool won 3-0 at Norwich. Nick, you were there.
Yes, I was there. It was a late night, but I sort of enjoyed it, really. And not just because I'm an Ipswich fan. I got 700 words from it in my report. There was quite a lot to mention in the end. Liverpool cruised it 3-0. They've beaten Norwich 3-0 away twice now in the space of 5.5 weeks with entirely different lineups. And Norwich got booed off a little bit at the end, which I thought doesn't really bode well given the start they've had. It doesn't feel like the happiest of environments for a newly promoted team. But the sort of key moment of the game, if you like, was when Norwich's very lively Greece forward, Christos Zolis, who they signed for $10 million from PAOK, I think last month, he'd kind of been their best player in the first half, but they were a goal down to Minamino's shot early on. And then he has a shot, and the Liverpool keeper, Kelleher, parries it. And then another Greek player, Giannoulis, is fouled in the box, and it's a penalty. And Zolis steps up to take it, and I didn't think too much of that, but I did notice a few raised eyebrows among some of the Norwich chess pack. So he took the penalty, and it was a bad penalty straight down the middle, and Kelleher saves it with his legs, and then Zolis rather embarrassingly air kicks the rebound. So Norwich's chance is basically gone, and Liverpool go on to win 3-0 in massive comfort. But Daniel Farker afterwards, I had a train to catch, and Farker talks for longer than any Premier League manager. That's a fact. Before their game against Watford the other week, I think one of the guys said he gave an answer that lasted 16 minutes. So I was on the clock, believe me. But I was very interested to hear his view of the penalty. And he said Christos was not the first on the team sheet to take it. He got greedy. If you do this, you have to make sure you score. Otherwise, you're in trouble. He will never do this mistake again in his life, that's for sure. And he went on to say how he'd made it crystal clear to him. So I don't know what went on in the tunnel or the dressing room after the game, but I think poor Zolis clearly got a bit of a rollicking from Farker for that, and clearly won't ever do it again.
Hopefully Zolis can find solace.
But a quantum of Zolis, and there was none for Norwich. Maybe they needed Mark Noble to come on and miss a penalty for them or something. But
well, interesting you say that. Jay has emailed to say, how do you feel about Andy Robertson coming on after 65 minutes for Kostas Tsimikas and sprinting across the whole pitch to immediately take the throw-in? Fortunately, the throw-in found the man, but would the panel rather a fresh Robertson with no practices before coming on, or a jaded Tsimikas finding a man with a throw-in to save their life? It's a very good question. The thing I liked from this game was the commentator, when the second goal went in, he went, it took them minutes at the start of the first half to get there first, and history has repeated itself for Liverpool at the start of the second. I'm not sure that's... I think that's a bit grand, isn't it? For getting a second goal away at Norwich in the Carabao Cup second round. Or that's history repeating itself, is it?
I felt like something big had happened in the stadium there. I looked at the person next to me, and he looked at me, and we both knew. We didn't have to say anything.
By any chance, Max, did the earthquake in Sydney coincide with the moment that goal went in?
I don't believe it did. I think it was hours later. Brentford 7, Oldham 0. 4 for 4s. Marcus Fors, a Finnish man, scored 4 goals. There was a nice overhead kick by Johan Wisser, which I'm giving 5.9 on the Sinclair Spectrum to anyone who wants to dig it out. Burnley 4, Rochdale 1. Jay Rodriguez scored 4 goals. So well done, Jay. After they went a goal behind, it was nice to see Aaron Lennon doing his little funny little quick legs down the right wing for Burnley in that game.
If I was a Burnley fan, I'd like Wilson thinks Sunderland's victory was a waste of goals and a clean sheet, I'd very much see that as a waste of 4 Jay Rodriguez goals, going by the same sort of thought process.
Well, he did it. I mean, what are you meant to do? I mean, could Sean Dyche admonish him like Daniel Fark admonished Zolis, going, I didn't want him to use his goals up today, the idiot. Lovely story from Craven Cottage. Leeds beat Fulham on penalties. Dan James' partner gave birth to a baby boy at lunchtime. He spent the afternoon with her. Then he got a helicopter down to London for the game, played the full match, scored a second penalty in the shootout. So well done to Dan.
And here we are saying that the Carabao isn't important.
He also said after the game that he and his partner, they haven't come up with a name yet, so the obvious one should be Carabao, you'd think.
It's extraordinary how attitudes on that kind of thing have changed. I think for the better. But I remember talking to Dennis Stewart, former Sunderland, Manchester City, New York Cosmos, 7 caps for England. And when his second son was born, he was playing away for Manchester City at Wolves. And he just he came to the dressing room at half time, and the manager goes, manager picks up the phone, goes, Dennis, it's a boy, puts the phone down, they carry on with the rest of the team talk.
Well, I remember John Barnes was doing punditry, and at half time, I'm sure this is true, and someone went, oh, wonderful news, John, your wife's in labour, so look, we'll see you, off you go. And he went, oh no, I'll stay for the second half. And And then watched the second half and then went off.
My father wasn't present for the birth of me or either of my sisters. What was he doing? He was at work.
He was with a cow.
Yeah. He may well have been helping someone else give birth at the time, a cow or a horse or a sheep.
Are you intending to be present for yours, or are you just going to be doing a podcast, doing a bit of talk sport or something? Phone in suggestions for what we call him.
We had a good tweet about this that I was going to do at the end of the pod, but since you brought it up, somebody said, you know, is Max announcing that he and his wife are expecting a child through a retweet of Nicki Minaj, the most obscure way anyone has decided to announce big news? She'd said, you know, the vaccine had made her cousin's friend impotent. And I was suggesting that I had the vaccine. And shortly after, Jamie became pregnant. Well, I mean, I presume I'm the father, of course. George says, if your kid is a boy, will you name it Barry? If it's a girl, will you still name it Barry? And actually, the best suggestion for a name for my child is Ian, obviously, which I think, give it a second.
Ah, yes.
Yeah. But I don't know how many Ians there are about these days. I intend to be there, Wilson. You know, who knows? You know, I have every intention. I suspect I will be. But, you know, you can't predict these things, can you? And obviously, if I'm doing the pod, then I'll carry on with the pod. Of course.
I mean, the Zoom means you can probably just do it from a ward, right?
I could pod from a maternity ward. I mean,
do you care about the job or not? How committed are you?
We could all be there for the birth of your child.
I think she'd love that. So what she wants to see is Barry's. One of my friends was giving birth, and there was a TV that I think had Soccer AM or Fantasy Football with the volume down, and she was like, that is not what I wanted to see when I was giving birth to my child. Anyway, that'll do for part one. We've got through most of the Carabao Cup games. We'll do the same again tomorrow, of course. And in part two, Susie Rack will join us to talk about sort of England's very comfortable start to World Cup qualifying. Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly. Guardian's women football correspondent, Susie Rack, joins us. Susie, hello.
Hey, Max, how are you doing?
I'm all right. So England's World Cup qualifiers played 2-1-2, 4-18 against 0. 10-0 against Luxembourg, 8-0 against North Macedonia. I don't know how much we can learn from these two games. The first game is under the new manager, Serena Wiegmann. What can we learn?
Not much. I mean, the two teams between them were ranked, well, one was ranked 120 something in the world and the other one was 131 in the world. So, yeah, I mean, there's little you can take from games like that. I think the biggest thing you can take is that World Cup qualifying needs pre-qualifiers because, I mean, the gap is just so, so massive. I think there were 8 games of 22 yesterday that had a 6-goal margin or more. There was at least 2 10-0 games. And England, I mean, are going to walk their group, but are going to smash every single team in the process. And it gets a little bit distasteful after a while. But Wiegmann comes across great. I mean, a breath of fresh air in comparison to Phil Neville, but it's not particularly hard to do as much as he's a fairly nice guy. The biggest takeaways that you could take from those two massive wins were that you could see some kind of progress between them. In the first game, they had 81% possessions, 46 shots, scored 8, missed so many chances, sitters, crosses in that should have been goals, and just weren't very clinical despite the like deceptive scoreline. And the second game, they were like by far more clinical in front of goal. Serena Wiegmann said that she wanted them to score more and be more clinical in between those games, and they were, is a good sign in that, you know, she's clearly having some effect. But yeah, I mean, it's hard to draw too many conclusions from 18 goals across 2 games against teams that are just, you know, amateur players, essentially.
Some very basic questions. When and where is this World Cup? And before that, we have the Euros, which is presumably what Wiegmann is really building towards because the Euros are in England.
Yeah, Euros in England next summer, which is exciting. Obviously, they were delayed by the pandemic pushing back the men's Euros and then that knocking on to the women's, which, like, one of the hard things I think about these games with massive score lines is they're not very helpful for the teams that are getting thrashed, but they're not very helpful for the teams that are winning by these massive score lines either, because England's biggest problem under Phil Neville was defence, and, you know, Mary Earps in goal didn't touch the ball for two games. The defence is very, very high, can rest on their laurels a little bit, and if anything, it can have a negative effect for them as much as the teams at the lower end. So in that sense, it's, you know, it's not necessarily ideal that England have to play all these games against lower teams as well in the run-up. The World Cup is 2023 in Australia. So hopefully you can get to some games.
Oh, right.
Okay. And New Zealand. It's being played across the two countries. But yeah, it's going to be, going to be a fantastic World Cup, because Australia have got absolutely massive on it. Had, like, Sam Kerr projected onto the side of the Sydney Opera House and stuff in the build-up. And
yes, I saw that. I should have put two and two together.
And have gone really, really massive on it. So, and, you know, then obviously done things like taken in a load of the Afghanistan athletes that have fled the country and things like that. And I think part of that has come from the fact that they're hosting this competition in a couple of years' time, and, you know, feel the pressure to not be too hypocritical on things as well. I think that's been a bonus on that score as well.
Susie, thanks so much for coming on.
No worries, catch you later.
Susie Rack there, The Guardian's women's football correspondent. Question from Cyrus Max. Is UEFA truly serious about tackling racist abuse? This Hungary 2-game ban is an absolute farce. They should just remove it so we know they've actually done nothing. Hungary have been ordered to play two matches behind closed doors by FIFA following the racism English players experienced in that World Cup qualifier in Budapest at the start of September. The second ground closure is suspended for 2 years. The Hungarian Football Federation has also been fined £158,000, 200,000 Swiss francs. FIFA takes a clear zero tolerance stance against such abhorrent behaviour in football, said a statement. They added, it remained firm and resolute in rejecting any form of racism and violence, as well as any other form of discrimination or abuse. You'll remember that in June, UEFA fined the Hungarian Federation £85,000, ordered a 3-game stadium closure, the final match being suspended for discriminatory behaviour by their supporters during Euro 2020. It really doesn't feel good enough, Wilson, does it? And suspending, why suspend one of them?
It doesn't feel good enough, but I mean, what I don't know, how do you put a price on it? I don't know. I don't know how you begin to do that. Yeah, you've got to bear in mind as well that Hungarian football is nowhere near as wealthy as English football. So I'm just not sure fines really do anything, to be honest. I think the notion of punishing the federation is difficult because you need the federation to be tackling the racism. You create these false incentives where it's in the interests of the federations to play down any racism to minimise their punishment. And what you want them to do is acknowledge what the problem is and then work with FIFA and UEFA and anti-racism groups to try and sort it out. But I don't know how you do sort it out. So I always think that the fining is slightly pointless. And then the discussion we have about how the fines are never enough is also slightly pointless, because what fine, how do you put a number on it? I just don't think you really can. Stadium closures, I'm sort of broadly against other than the sort of final instance, but I think we probably have reached that point with Hungary now because it's been so consistent over the last couple of years. So is it enough? Probably not. Would anything be enough? Also probably not. Is anything adequate? No, also probably not.
The only way to hit football where it hurts, I think, is by not playing football, right? So would the next step, or the logical step here even, have been banning them from a set of qualifiers for the next ones? I know that punishes the players, but if what we've already spoken about doesn't go far enough, which it doesn't, and I think the totting up procedure of offences should be a lot tighter and a lot more rigorous, Then what other option is there than to take away the football from the people who are using football in such a shockingly horrible way?
But I think that is massively unfair on those players, and it also has exactly the same problem. It encourages the individual federations to play down the racism. I think if they can't provide a safe environment, then closed stadiums or not playing games in Hungary makes sense as a sort of last resort. To expel them from the competition, I think, is incredibly unfair on players who, with the homophobic stuff during the Euros, Peter Gulacsi, the goalkeeper, had actively spoken against that in Germany, and a TV commentator who'd come out in support of him was then taken off commentary in Hungary for it. So the players are in an incredibly difficult position. I don't see it's fair for them to be punished for this.
But then what is fair here and what can be fair?
I think there's a desire to punish, to be seen to be doing something, but I don't actually think that makes any difference at all. It's very easy to go, let's punish some people and we'll feel better because we've done something, but it hasn't actually solved the problem at all. All it's done is said, we've done something.
If you ban people from a stadium, the thinking is that the next time that they're allowed in the stadium, they won't be racist. And that is very unlikely to be the case, right?
But you're also assuming kind of everybody acting in good faith. I think there's, you know, if you're a far right wing Hungarian ultra, the Hungary national team getting results on the pitch is actually pretty low down your list of priorities.
And Max, I mean, a lot of England fans disgrace themselves at the Euro 2020 final. How would you feel if England were slung out of the next set of qualifiers?
Well, Ants habitually disgrace themselves with away games all the time. Not necessarily with homophobia or racism, although there is certainly some of that, but just by being boorish in bars around places, to the, you know, that makes going to England away games to cover them, certainly as a journalist, really unpleasant.
The point about that is a lot of those England fans genuinely don't see anything wrong with the manner in which they sort of, in inverted commas, occupy a big square in, I don't know, Zagreb or Lisbon or wherever, or Amsterdam, and start, you know, making fun of poor people chucking bottles and chairs around. They just see that as a bit of harmless banter.
There appears to be, or there feels to me, a difference between what happens in a ground and not in a ground. Is that, where do you draw the line? Certainly for a federation's point of view or an FA's point of view.
Well, in terms of providing a safe environment for the game to happen, I think that's absolutely right. There's clearly some sort of narrow perimeter to the ground where the club has to take responsibility for that. It's a club or the federation's responsibility to provide a safe environment for football to be played. And if they can't provide that, then they have to play without fans or play in a different country or a different city. But that's why I sort of always felt uncomfortable about federations being expected to take responsibility for fans. They have absolutely no authority over them.
Sorry, would it be better for UEFA and FIFA, who have money, to use that money to pay for more policing, or to the point more surveillance, so that the Hungarian Federation or whoever, or, you know, the English FA at Wembley could pinpoint every single person that is being racist or being homophobic or being antisocial, and then find out who they are and
well, yeah, possibly. I mean, I don't know to what extent that is an issue at, say, Wembley, where you obviously have very good, you know, facilities, and they should have cameras that can pick people out individually. I don't know to what extent that was an issue. I clearly, with poorer federations, that is an issue. So yeah, that would appear a thing to do to pinpoint the people actually causing the problems. But I sort of think these are issues which run way, way, way deeper. You know, to take Hungary as an example, when you have a prime minister in Viktor Orban who is very right wing, whose base is people from outside Budapest, largely, you know, it's not particularly an urban phenomenon, who have a sort of anti-immigrant, nationalistic, anti-gay culture. It's not really the Hungarian Football Federation's job to sort that out. That's a problem that goes way, way beyond their remit. And all they can be expected to do is to provide a safe environment for football to be played.
All right. Look, it's a conversation we'll come back to again and again and again, sadly. But that'll do for part two. Part three, we'll begin with Nick's travels in Moldova. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly. Nick, you went to FC Sheriff, Transnistria's biggest club, making their debut in the Champions League as a Moldovan club, even if they don't say they're Moldovan themselves. And there's a fascinating backstory to this whole club. And it's way too simple to just say plucky little Sheriff won their first game in the Champions League, even if that is also possibly true.
Yeah, I went out there last week for two or three days. I normally cover Arsenal. That's the club I cover on a week-to-week basis, but I had to go that far for some European football to cover this season. So we're getting pretty desperate to find some use for me. I mean, you've spelt out the sort of competitive context there. Transnistria is a de facto independent state that is not recognised by international law or by the UN or anything like that. It's a sliver of land, maybe 150 miles long, about 20 miles wide, on the end of Moldova, bordering largely with Ukraine. And Sheriff Tiraspol, FC Sheriff, they play in the Moldovan League. Even though the sense of pride and nationalism, but I don't say that pejoratively, in Transnistria is very evident. They don't see themselves as Moldovan whatsoever. On the whole, they play in the Moldovan League, and almost ever since they were founded in about 1997, they have ripped it up. It's a name that many people will know from maybe previous Europa Leagues. They played Spurs a few years ago. They've come close at the final hurdle many times to nearly get into the Champions League. This year they made it. So I thought I'd go along and see, because it's very unusual to see a team that purports, as far as its fans are concerned, and maybe it is concerned, to represent a country that does not exist. As far as the wider world is concerned, if you're still with me. I mean, the setup there is absolutely bizarre. What you've basically got is a company called Sheriff that was set up by two apparently ex-KGB officers running the country. And you go to Transnistria, you've got the Sheriff Football Club, but you've got Sheriff gas stations, you've got Sheriff supermarket, Sheriff hypermarket, Sheriff beer, Sheriff milk, Sheriff Internet, Sheriff TV, Sheriff phone line. Everything is Sheriff. It is utterly consuming and utterly bizarre. And in these hypermarkets, you've got these immaculately dressed blue tunic, red shirt cashiers, sort of in these long, long lines, and all these goods that equivalent versions of Western brands. And it's very sort of Truman Show almost. But anyway, Sheriff has this absolute stranglehold on the entire country, and they've managed to fund through whatever means, and there's a lot of allegations about how they have done it. Transnistria is quite notorious for, let's say, not having the tightest of border controls in terms of moving goods. They have funded a football team that is very, very good. I mean, the game I went to watch them play was against Shakhtar Donetsk, who sort of set the standard for buying and reselling and using to very good effect Brazilians and other South Americans and some Africans in an Eastern European team. And they totally out-Shakhtar'd Shakhtar when I was there. They won 2-0, had a Brazilian left-back who was brilliant, striker from Mali called Adama Traore, not that one, etc., who scored a fantastic volley, won 2-0, didn't have a lot of the ball, but played very cleverly, totally deserved it. And they look like a team that can probably grow from here. But I guess what I went there to think about, I didn't come back with many answers, was exactly what Sheriff Tiraspol represents and how much that matters. Because Transnistria is very closely aligned to Russia. And as I said before, most of the people there will repudiate any sort of formal connection with Moldova, feeling Moldovan, anything like that. People speak Russian. A lot of people I met were wearing Transnistrian flags, like pin badges on their shirts and stuff. A Transnistrian flag flies high above government buildings next to the Russian flag. You've got a bookshop where the Transnistria president, he's up there pictured next to Putin and Stalin on the wall and stuff like that. So make no mistake, that is generally the direction of travel. It's maybe shifting slightly, but generally. I was trying to unpick how important the team is to people there and what it means. And it kind of opened a lot of wider questions for me, I suppose, about football and representation. And there's certainly a scale of bad in terms of football club ownerships, and I don't know where Sheriff sit on that, but to what extent is it more important that a football club at least means something to some people and gives them a sense of identity that maybe they couldn't express before and is important in that way? On the other hand, I think, I mean, I spent some time in the Moldovan capital, Chisinau, and I think a lot of people there, certainly in the Moldovan FA, were quite keen to use the fact that Sheriff fly under the Moldovan flag legally and as part of UEFA, and that it reflects as good PR almost for Moldovan football as well, and for potential investors in Moldovan football, for people like ourselves who might look and think, why is there a Moldovan team in there? So there was a lot of different sides to it. Fascinating place. It's I mean, if you read the literature before going, you hear a lot about it being a slice of the 1980s and Soviet communist ephemera everywhere, stuff like that. And it really is. It's like being in a very remote provincial mid-sized Russian city, I would say. And you've got your Lenin bus everywhere and your trolley buses going up and down, and not much English spoken. It's kind of like the late 1980s, if the late 1980s had serviceable Wi-Fi in 60% of cafes, I suppose. But people were extraordinarily friendly, very happy to talk. The taxi driver tests that I undertook found very little interest in FC Sheriff in men over probably 40 or 50, maybe those who'd seen a bit of the Soviet era. Although most of them have heard of The Guardian, funnily enough, which is not
love the pod. We're big in Sheriff.
Well, so I'm actually leaving to helm the new Tiraspol bureau next week. But I felt to younger people, even if they didn't attend the game week in, week out, it was at least important that this Champions League thing was happening and that it did put where they were from on the map. And whether it's good, whether it's bad, it's hard to say, but it did make me think and then not decide much.
No, that's fine. Didn't have to come back with answers. I just found that all very interesting. I like the idea of a picture of the president, Putin, Stalin and Barry, just, you know, behind every counter and every newsagent who knew you were so big in the enclaves beyond Moldova, Barry. Sam has a question. When Manchester United win the league on the back of Ronaldo's golden boot winning season, will Jonathan Wilson have to do some kind of forfeit? Drake says, how much closer to the bottom of Serie A would Juventus be if Ronaldo was still there scoring goals for them? Question for Wilson from PV. With Ronaldo gone, what is holding Juventus back now? They're currently 18th. Wilson, Ronaldo's scoring goals. Juventus aren't doing as well. Manchester United are doing quite well. Are you joining me in the humble pie aisle?
No.
Okay.
For what? No, none of this is anything other than what was entirely predictable, what I did indeed predict would happen. Yeah, I don't know why you indulge these people. They Ronaldo was always going to score goals for United, but I think structurally he makes them less likely to beat the best sides. So they may even get more points than last season, because one of the things they struggled to do last season was beat teams like West Brom and Sheffield United. His firepower clearly will help beat them. Will it help them actually beat the best sides? I'd be very surprised if it does. Well, okay, I'll say I was wrong, but I don't think that will happen. We've seen, you know, they've had huge problems in midfield against Newcastle, against Young Boys, which people seem to have forgotten about already. Those people that you were reading out the questions from. And against West Ham, they were overrun in midfield. So Ronaldo causes structural problems in the side. Of course his goals help. And, I always said he would score 20, 25, maybe more goals. Juventus, he was holding them back tactically and financially. And those things aren't solved by him leaving. Yeah, that's the beginning of a process. Yeah, he left right towards the end of a transfer deadline. Juve didn't get a transfer fee for him, or got a very small transfer fee for him. Yeah, nowhere near recouping the 100 million they paid for him. They got his wages off the books. But they didn't have time to go out and buy another centre forward. So, of course, there's going to be problems as Allegri came in and tried to restructure and tried to get a team actually playing proper football rather than just playing to the famous bloke up front. I mean, that was always going to happen. I mean, yeah, I didn't expect him to be 18th at this point, but I equally didn't expect him to be romping away with the league, winning every game 4-0. Nothing has changed. And it's boring that you let these people who don't understand things, who are clearly just trolling, dictate. I know it's a Carabao Cup, I know we've got nothing to talk about, but we could talk about Endeavour rather than this nonsense.
Oh, well, that's a good point you make. Ed says, thoughts on Jack Swift's transfer to Ajax? Presumably Oxford Wanderers received a decent fee. Who in that Ajax team is he going to replace?
Well, it's interesting, isn't it? Because this appeared to happen in, I think, May 1971. There's a reference when, what's he called? The other sergeant that goes on to become a superintendent.
Strange, is it?
Strange. So when Strange asks Joan out, I think it's mentioned that it's May. And there's also a reference in another newspaper article to the Lions tour of Australia and New Zealand, which I think began in May 1971 and went on for about 3 months. So I think we can safely say this is May 1971. So he's leaving at the end of the season. There's a couple of slightly odd things there. So one is, it was suggested in the first episode of the series that Swift was coming to the end, that Oxford was looking to offload him. I find it implausible that Ajax, having just won the European Cup, would think, you know what, rather than playing Johnny Rep, who we've got coming through our youth team, we'll turn to a hard-drinking, overweight, superannuated Northern Irish striker from Oxford Wanderers. That seems implausible. I believe there have only ever been two British players who've played for Ajax. The first was Ray Clark, who went their extraordinary career path. I think Swindon he started at. I went from Swindon to Mansfield to Sparta Rotterdam to Ajax. And actually had a very good season. I think he scored 26 goals there, 77-8 or 78-9. And then there's Ali Dick, who I'd forgotten about, and people on Twitter reminded me. He played 11 games there. He was Scottish. Played 11 games there in, I think, between 86 and 88. Rangers had considered signing him, but decided against it because he was Catholic. But when Ajax came trying to sign Davy Cooper, they said, you can't have Davy Cooper, but there's this lad. I think he was at Tottenham at the time and then went to Ajax, but only played 11 games and then went off to North America. I think he only ever played one game in Scotland, which was right at the end of his career for Alloa. It's not totally implausible, but if I'd been employed as a consultant, as surely I will be soon, I would have advised against it.
But I mean, even at the most basic level, and I should probably point out for listeners who may not be aware of it, Endeavour is sort of the Morse origin story. So Endeavour Morse is the detective. But the first episode of the latest series kicks off, and in the opening credit, we see a game being played by Oxford Wanderers, a cup match, and they're playing in torrential rain. The pitch is an absolute mud bath. They're in the very last couple of minutes of added time, and yet every single Oxford Wanderers player's white shirt is pristine. There's not even a spatter of mud on it. Then later in the episode, we see a training session, and one of the Oxford Wanderers players is training while wearing a scarf from the club shop. Like,
oh, lovely.
Who does that? Nobody. It would be so easy to get these things right, and yet...
So what, actually, to be fair, I mean, look, I broadly agree with you. There was it Albert Quixel? There was a Manchester United player, late 50s, early 60s, who had quinsies and used to have to train in a scarf.
He had what, sorry?
Quinsies, which are like an inflammation of the throat.
Is that like glandular? Did he have glandular fever? Is that what you're saying?
No, I think quinsies are one of those sort of malnutrition diseases that we don't really get anymore. I mean, look, I'm not a doctor. I don't know. Don't.
Like rickets.
Yeah, I think it's... I mean, look, as I say, I don't know. I
Mickey Quinsey's, is that what you're saying?
But this, yeah, that first episode of the series, I think, was by some margin the worst Endeavour there's been. They do so much to get the period detail right. Even things like when they're having a drink in the bar afterwards, the players are in club tracksuits. You know, early 70s, it wouldn't have happened. They'd have been wearing suits. Well, what level are they? It's very hard to tell. And it was going to be a big shock if it had gone out the FA Cup to Cowley. So we assume they're a first division team because Jack Swift was meant to be this big star, somebody who was being targeted by a terror group. I mean, you just don't target sort of third division strikers if you're terror. I mean, it's a low grade terror group. But then the stadium, you know, wasn't a particularly big stadium.
And also the players who turned up in the players' lounge after the game in their tracksuits had all arrived wearing civilian clothes.
Yes. Yeah, yeah. So the whole thing was very... And I thought sort of the characterisation was poor, the plotting was poor, the acting was poor. I thought it was a terrible first episode. I thought this week's was a lot better, although the denouement was bizarre.
I'm slightly concerned that you're more interested in this than the Carabao Cup second round. I believe our remit what people come to this podcast for. Well, who knows? Can we just finally point out a lot of people got in touch with us with John Arnold's tweet. He writes and broadcasts about CONCACAF, and his tweet yesterday was, so the vice president of Suriname, whose name is Ronnie Brunswick, who is 60 years old, is playing in the CONCACAF League for, and I hope I pronounce this correctly, Inter Moengotapoe, captaining the team he owns against a team called Olympia from Honduras. He played 54 minutes. According to Wikipedia, he completed 14 of 17 passes and was replaced by his son, Damien. So, and there's a lovely picture of him pointing, gesticulating at his teammates. He's not svelte, Ronnie, anymore at 60. But that is a decent pass completion rate, isn't it? 14 out of, I'd be happy with that, 14 out of 17. So, yeah, why not, eh?
I think they should put him up top with the president of Burundi, Pierre Nkurunziza, off the top of my head, who I think plays up front or sometimes moonlights up front for a team that he founded in the Burundi top flight, and he's a similar age, and I think magically manages to knock quite a few in when he plays. So yeah, there's a. Maybe a budding strike partnership there one day.
Victor Orban, of course, is very keen on football, and there was certainly a period when most of his cabinet had played for his five-a-side team.
I mean, that's not quite the same as putting yourself out in the top division.
Well, no, okay. So the Puskás Academy, which he founded in 2006, finished second in the Hungarian League last season, playing in a stadium in his home village, which has a capacity double the population of that village. It's not quite the same, but it is pretty bad.
Anyway, we are all Ronnie Brunswick. If I ever buy a football team, I'll be on the bench. I think I put myself on the bench. No, I think you've got to have some integrity, haven't you? It's all gone. Anyway, I think we've run out of time. We had some lovely emails that we can't read out because we've got to finish and we've got to be back tomorrow.
We've wasted too much time on Ronaldo and pointless Ronaldo stuff.
I thought you had a good... I've done actual prep for the Ryder Cup question you flagged up before.
Oh, okay then. Oh, fine. Okay. Well, in which case, I've deleted it. Where's it gone? Somebody, and I do apologise, if I press Control Z enough times, it'll come back. Yeah, here we go. Bob says, who would win in a football Ryder Cup? Best combined 11 from the Americas, North and South, versus Europe? And where will Arsene Wenger suggest it? Barry, you've done some prep.
Well, I just... From North America alone, you've got quite a decent Ryder Cup team, right? So you've got Brad Faxon Friedel. Yeah.
Okay.
John Brooks Koepka. Raul Miguel Angel Jimenez. And Sergino Garcia Dest. There's some good golfers.
Well done. Is that all? Is that, have you finished the prep now?
Yeah, it wasn't much prep.
You made us carry on the pod for that.
Well, you can always go back and just finish it without that bit.
No, you can't. It's
13
fine.
Of the last 16 World Cup semi-finalists have been European, so I think the Europeans will win quite easily.
Okay, that's the funny answer from Wilson. There we are.
I'm bored. Let's finish it.
Okay. Nick, thanks for coming on.
Pleasure, Max. Cheers.
Thank you, Wilson.
Cheers.
Thanks, Barry.
You're welcome.
Back tomorrow, we'll do the rest of the Carabao Cup second round, but also talk about Derby County going into administration. Kieran Maguire from the Price of Football podcast will join us for that.
In good news for you, I am live blogging all the Carabao Cup action tonight, so you don't have to watch any of it.
Ah, you're a good man, Barry, and I love you.
This is The Guardian.